Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is also a host on BBS Radio called Beyond the Matrix. It's Patricia Corey, and I can vouch for the fact that she is a renowned author. I've read some of her books. They're excellent, very spiritual. She is a teacher and a spiritual guide to the sacred sites of the earth. And for more than 30 years, she has studied mysticism, philosophy, ancient civilizations, metaphysical healing, and spirituality. And I could go on and on. She's written so many books and she's done so many things and visited practically everywhere on this earth in the pursuit of knowledge and experience. Now, she has just released a book which came out at the end of last year called Where Pharaohs Dwell, and that's going to be the main basis of our conversation and this program. Having said all that, it's probably taking your breath away, Patricia. Welcome to the program.
Jeez, that is some introduction. Thank you very much.
I hope
have
you can
I done
relax.
All of that already?
Yeah, well, I wonder how you have any time for a home life. I mean, do you have a family, just as a matter of interest?
I have a partner who I've been with for 26 years. And I have three dogs. Unfortunately, no children in this lifetime. Sure there was a reason for that.
Yes.
But I do have to admit that all the things I'm doing for spirit have been sort of taking me away from my dogs and my man, and I hope to rectify that in 2012 when we go through the shift.
Right. You've opened something there that I was going to mention. What I'd like to do is just cover one or two things that you have obviously firm opinions on before we get into the book. Now, you've mentioned 2012, and I know that's something you like to talk about. What do you think it means to most people, or indeed, what does it mean to you?
I like to help people understand that 2012 is more than just a date that we fixate upon. Some people worry about, and others look forward to with anticipation. So I like to remind people that 2012 is a concept, it's a paradigm, it's an opening, and that we are already in this process. And that rather than fixate on the date, the big December 21st date, 2012, that we start to change our perception and understand that we are in this process. We are careening into this whirlwind vortex of change. Yeah. And that the sooner we embrace the idea that we're already in it and surviving it, the sooner we will understand that it's going to be a process that we determine, that the collective consciousness determines how swiftly and how and with what ease we pass through this process. I personally believe that we will wake up on December 22nd, 2012 and say, whoa, okay, here we are, and embracing the idea of an entire process, we won't have to have that jarring experience of the date and what follows, but rather knowing that we're in this process and it's going to be gracious. A few hiccups, but we're going to be fine.
Right, now, some people have put forward the idea over the years, and not too long ago, that the actual change will occur when we enter the photon belt, and there is likely to be a 3-day period of darkness. And then we would wake up to the new consciousness levels and whatever that brings. Have you got any belief in that, or do you think that is another possible alternative?
I do believe that if enough conscious thought is given to any concept, it can be created. As individuals, we create our own reality, and as a collective, we create the Earth reality. So if enough people buy into any given idea, then we can actually manifest it. But I personally don't agree with this 3 days of darkness paradigm. And according to my sources, which you know are the Syrian High Council, when we go through this shift, which is not necessarily exactly on that date, they call it the ascension of the sun, moving through the ascension cords of the sun, which the scientists are still calling dark holes, that it's going to be so fast, faster than the speed of light, that we won't even recognize that it's happened.
Right.
Because if you consider our perception of how light moves, it's pretty difficult for us to perceive or even conceive of anything faster than that.
Yes, yes.
And the council say we're going to move through this process faster than the speed of light.
Right. Well, that would be nice.
So I don't agree with that 3-day darkness, and I don't want it. I want more light, not more darkness.
I mean, there have been many ideas put forward for quite some years, and I think because everything is so fluid and flexible, it's quite possible that the people who contributed to that idea might now feel there is something different going to happen, but it was certainly put forward, I think, prior to the millennium. Now, you've mentioned the Syrian High Council. Tell our listeners what your link is to the Syrians and how it came about.
Yes, I can, but I would just like to refer back to what you just said, which I agree with completely, and I would like to suggest that it's also possible that those who believe that's going to happen will create it in their realities as a separate or an aspect of the overall situation, because the truth is, anything goes here.
Yes.
So it's very exciting to contemplate. For example, if we are moving into the next dimension, then the metaphysicians are discussing how we will be creating reality in that dimension and how it will be. So if you have a belief that you're going to be in 3 days of darkness, you may very well find yourself there, whereas others won't.
Yes.
So
yeah,
I do honor everyone's opinion. I just personally don't adhere to that idea. And I don't want to.
I go along with what you say regarding the creation of our own reality. What we believe in, we create for ourselves. So presumably, in the end, everybody will be happy.
Exactly. And everybody will be also receiving the teachings from what they've created.
Right. Now, so, I'll leave 2012 for the moment, because that's not the whole purpose of having you on the program. But what I also would like to ask you is, what's your take on crop circles? What do you think the intention is of them, and who puts them there?
Well, you're talking about one of my favorite subjects. In fact, I'm going again this year. I go every year. And my take on the crop circles, the ones that are real, is that these are designs of human of consciousness that are being sent into the human density or experience from other dimensional realms. And the Syrian High Council call them lock-on points for extra-dimensional consciousness. And in fact, I'm working on a new book now, after the Pharaoh's book, which is talking more about this and how the logical or the language of the cosmos is number. It's not going to be English. It's going to be some Star Wars language. The one communicative mechanism that we can call language that will work with any conscious society is number.
Right,
it may not be the same exact number system, but number, ratio, and sacred geometry, or the council call cosmometry. That is, the divine made into, represented through pictograms, representing ratio, proportion, Pythagorean stuff. And that's what the crop circles are usually about, representing galactic images. We see some with orbits, as if we're being told something about other galaxies or other systems. But one common denominator they usually have is that they can be studied from the point of view of number, geometry, and proportion and ratio.
Right.
So that this is very exciting, that this is what we're getting. And the council say that this is a precursor to when the ships of not ET, not extra-dimensional beings, but actual ET ships will start to appear in the sky and dance around for us. They're not going to come in as warriors. They're going to come in as geometers.
That's wonderful. Now, you picked on a subject there that's close to my heart. When do you think that might happen? Have you been given any hints at all as to when they may openly come to Earth?
Yes. I think it could very well be this year, 2010. I thought it might make it last year, but the Council never really spell things out by dates because they are the master teachers of how we affect constantly change reality. And some people might think that's a cop-out, but it's really true. We, so many times, seers have given a date and the date doesn't manifest because so much other conscious intention has gone into altering that date or not seeing that thing, such a thing manifest. But the Council are definitely speaking now loudly about this is the time for, and it all ties in with the evolution of 2012. Contact.
Yes.
Once and for all. And remember, not for the first time, because we have record of alien contact with different civilizations throughout the human record.
Yes.
So it's just that this will be the first global contact, undeniable, irrefutable, welcome to the galaxy of conscious beings.
That's exactly what we want.
And I think we are looking at this in 2010.
Yes, that's great. I'm sure all of our listeners are totally agreeing with you on that. We're looking forward to that time.
Yes, we are.
Do you think that when people look at the crop circles, or when they even are there and enter them, do you think the energy or the symbology subconsciously leaves a message with you?
Absolutely. I don't think you need to be a psychic to get that. First of all, when you're in a crop circle, there's a certain fraternity that you feel, and it's bigger than just with the other people that are in the crop circle with you. There's something unexplainable that you feel, and it's something like wonder, excitement. It's very hard to put into language, but it's a connectedness that you know something bigger than what you are able to perceive is happening. This is the common thread that people experience in the crop circles, and they're never the same. I bring people every year, and every year people continually write to me and tell me how it has impacted their lives, knowing that these are very likely the first tangible communications that we are receiving on a global scale.
Right. Do we know who is actually making the crop circles, or are there indeed several different civilizations that are reaching us that way?
We know that these, according to the Syrians, these are not people confuse and think that these are extraterrestrial races, and the Council say no, these are extra-dimensional conscious manifestations of extra-dimensional consciousness. So they take credit a lot for this. And other dimensions are working with the crop circles, too. This is a phenomenon of global, multidimensional connection to planet Earth. So we have Syrians, we've got the Arcturians, we've got the Pleiadians. I think they're all involved. But the Syrians are the masters of cosmometry and proportion and dimension. So they are very busy out there in the field. And this is one of the reasons why your question earlier, how did I get into touch with them, comes to play.
Right.
Shall I explain?
Now. Yes.
I was called into the crop circles for the first time in 1996. I was in England studying at a color healing school, and I had a vision that I was flying over Stonehenge, and I saw this huge spiral next to it. And a voice said, pay attention. This is a lock-on point for extra-dimensional consciousness, and it's going to be very important to you. And I woke up. It was 4 o'clock exactly. I drew out this image. I was so excited I couldn't get back to sleep. And understandably, I mean, I pay attention when I have these dreams.
Oh, yeah.
I shared this with the girls in the college, and a couple days later, we went to Glastonbury on a field trip, and I saw this image on a postcard, like on a poster in a bookstore. Identical. And I was like, what is that? And this woman said, it's a crop circle, the latest crop circle. I said, what? What? This spiral that Julia said, is crop circle? It's 151 perfect circles in, if you know what Fibonacci sequence is. It's a ratio 1.618 growth from one point to the next point. So it was a perfect Fibonacci sequence, which is a Pythagorean based understanding of proportion. And it was identical to what I'd seen. So that, for a number of things, managed to get me into that crop circle. That was the first one. And I lost consciousness for 2 hours.
Gosh.
2 hours of spinning around out in the multiverse. And when I finally came back into my body, I can say truly it was the ultimate tune-up of my life. And shortly thereafter, I started to receive the messages, which you know as the Syrian Revelation.
All right. Yeah. Well, have you been to Stonehenge on more than one occasion?
I go every year.
You go every year, right. There was a little incident that you mentioned on the website, which occurred at one of them regarding the birds. Would you like to just relate that one?
Yes. Oh, I'm so delighted that you really do explore my work. Thank you.
Hmm.
Last year, I was telling people, or explaining to people, that the shamanic approach to any sacred site is very different than just walking in. It's somewhere between ritual and just quiet, and it is about unlocking the wisdom, unlocking what I call unlocking the gate. So if you're with a shaman who knows how to do that, the experience is completely different than you just going and looking at or getting close. This is unlocking the gate to the mysteries and to the energies that are there. So this year we went, and I can be a bit of an old granny because I ask people to, from the minute we walk, to please be in silence. And this can bother people. They're excited and they want to talk about it, and wow, look at Stone. And I say, please understand a very important principle. Getting into the site is just as important as being there. And that is a motto for the entire life process. Getting there is just as important, if not more, than being there. So we walked up. I have a certain place where I enter the stones because I bring people in for private session, and we have the whole place to ourselves for an hour, and we are allowed to go into the center of the stone structures. And I was wondering if anybody would notice, but for me, the birds are always the guardians of sacred sites. So as we were walking up, there were 100 black birds sitting on one of the top stones. And I don't want to say they were menacing, but they were most definitely guarding the site. And by that I mean, you don't ask permission, you don't get to feel anything more than delight at being there. And so as we approached, I saw them and I stopped the group and I looked at them and I said, may I have permission to enter here? And then I do my shamanic stuff, and whew, all 100 birds, the moment I made that request, flew off the stone together. And they opened the gate.
Amazing.
And a few people understood what was happening. Most of them were distracted, but a few people got it. And fortunately, that the person who took that photo, I always actually tell people, please don't take photos when we're going into a ceremony. So she kind of took it on the sneak and captured that moment. And it truly is magnificent.
Yes, indeed. Right, that's interesting. Now, I think we had better get on to your new book. Otherwise, people will be phoning in complaining that we're not talking about the thing we should do. So, Where Pharaohs Dwell. Now, you've described yourself, other people has, as sort of a female Indiana Jones, and reading up some of your adventures and where you've been, I'm not surprised in a way. Tell us where you got the idea from to write that book?
All of my work up until that book was channeled information from the Syrians. And a number of people said, Patricia, your life is so amazing. You really should write about your own experiences. To which I've always replied, my experiences are not important. What's important as a teacher is your experience and me doing what I can to facilitate that. But the experiences that I have in Egypt, and actually in many places, are so phenomenal that I really did think, you know, this is a story that should be told. As long as it's told in egoless narrative, I want to bring this forward and do it without holding back, and do it with neither holding back on the esoteric experience, neither glorifying it. So it was quite a balance, a delicate catwalk, they say, to make sure that I stayed in that balance. But I have had so many life-altering experiences in Egypt. And it began, my desire to tell the story began, as the book begins, when I went to a hypnotist for a past life regression. He was an expert, very powerful person. And to my surprise, I recovered a past life in Egypt where I was buried alive in a tomb.
My goodness.
And sadly, this memory came forward in this regression, and I almost died in the regression because I was suffocating, and he couldn't get me out. He couldn't get me out of the regressive state. So it was a dangerous little adventure that I went on, but it brought forward two names that I went on to investigate in reality, and the book is about discovering who I was. And just so you know, it wasn't Nefertiti, it wasn't Cleopatra, it wasn't any pharaoh.
Oh, what a shame.
So, but it's a journey to that discovery, and in the meantime, adventures and so many things that I've gone through, working with the gods and goddesses of Egypt, working with the people, getting in and out of tight situations, to put it mildly, and exploring those with the reader.
Let me ask you a question about that experience. Were you buried alive accidentally? I mean, did they think you had died and you were not? I mean, what was the reason for that?
Well, that'll give away the whole book.
Oh, right.
the discovery that comes out in the first chapter is one of being deliberately pushed into this tomb, and hearing the door slam shut, and screaming and begging and calling for help, and knowing that I was being murdered.
Gosh.
And this was a very intense, because in that process, in the regression, of course, talking with the regressor, or the hypnotist later, he said, I couldn't reach you anymore. I said, Patricia, I thought I was going to lose you, because I heard this huge rock wall slam close, and I was running out of air, and so I was hyperventilating in the chair.
Yes.
But yes, I was murdered, and quite violently. And this took part of the theme of this book, because there are a few currents running through the book, is to rediscover who that was and why.
Yes.
I was
right.
Murdered so brutally.
We had better leave that one where it is.
Have you read it yet?
No, I couldn't get the book in time, if you recall. But there wasn't enough time to get it here.
Right.
So I will be looking forward to getting a copy and reading it, because Egypt is one of my first interests, along with Atlantis. Now, you talk about going up and down, I guess, rickety steel ladders below the pyramids, to nights spent alone in ancient temples. You've got a lot of guts there to do all these things.
Yes, I do. I admit it. Sometimes I shock myself.
Right. I mean, what were you doing going up and down the ladders?
Well, I had an opportunity to go into this 33-meter deep tunnel or shaft, which has been called by Zahi Hawass, the antiquities director, the Osiris shaft, because he made a claim that this may very well be the tomb of Osiris, which it is not. And very few people have been able to go down there. It's completely off the record. It's totally guarded with a submachine gun guard right near it and whatever. But I'm very blessed. I opened the gate. And so I wanted to go there, and as I was sitting there contemplating how to get in there, a series of events happened. A person came into the cafe where I was. Turns out, yes, it could be done, and within 24 hours, I was going down. And that was probably the most arduous experience of my life. The first day, I started to go down and said, this is ridiculous. This is where I draw the limit. And I came back up. And then I went again. And I was going down there to discover, well, I don't know what I was going to discover. It was there. And I went. And what I discovered was some pretty heavy-duty energy that really blew me away. There is a sarcophagus, they call it a sarcophagus down there, with four broken pillars. And people are asking what this is. Zahi Hawass says it's the tomb of Osiris. I don't think so. I think there's a series of so-called sarcophagi around the Great Pyramid, and that they serve as some kind of intense energy system, like batteries storing God knows what kind of energies, which I'm exploring. But these were not places that people were supposed to go. I was definitely warned to get out of there by, let's say, astral beings that were guarding the place.
Is this anything to do with the passageways and the caves that seem to have a temple built in them that was discovered well before the last war, I think in maybe the 1920s or 30s?
I'm sure it does, but we know that there is a whole system, there's a whole city underneath the Giza Plateau, and that there are countless tunnels and walkways even that run underneath there. And I do believe the Egyptian government is very busy at work excavating down there.
Yes.
In fact, when I went down to the shaft, I could barely make anything out because it was the lighting was terrible and it was dank, and I have to admit that I had a little fear. I was more than happy to climb back out of there when I was told to get out.
Yeah.
But the person who opened that door for me told me that there are arches that are filled with rubble now that he believes are entrances to more tunnels.
Mm. Very exciting, isn't it?
It is. It's very exciting. I wish I had a 20-year-old body and a lot more courage than I have. But I managed to do my best.
We'd all like one.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I tell you what, it might be better, nice to have the 20-year-old body, but I wouldn't really want to be a 20-year-old person on this planet. I'm enjoying being right here, right now, with all the experience that brings you forward.
Now, was it at that time when you were doing this investigative work that you spoke to the ancient spirits?
For somebody that hasn't read the book, you know a lot about it. All that intuitive research you're doing, hey?
Oh, no, I've read it in in the notes that have been sent to me. The press.
I got myself locked into the temple at Abydos. This is a great story, and it's a big story in the book. And if you don't mind me running off without you having a chance to speak, I will try to condense it into a brief.
Indeed, do that.
Okay.
Carry on, yeah.
I I am not afraid of spirits, and I was a little bit shocked in the shaft because what was down there was pretty heavy stuff. But in this magnificent village of Abydos, which is in Upper Egypt, kind of off the tourist track, lies probably the most holy temple remaining in Egypt. And it's very intact energetically. And it sits on top of a structure called the Osirian, which I do believe is 50,000 years old. So going there is always a delight, and I always get enormous information when I'm there. And I've become very close with the people there because I go a lot, and it doesn't have that Egypt commercialism to it because, as I said, it's off the track to commercial tourism. So I told the person who is, let's say, the key figure there that I wanted to be in the temple alone, and he said, okay, Patricia, we can manage it. I said, no, I mean completely alone. Because when I go in there, I can feel the spirits in there are very vibrant. But there are guards and people and children, and it's never quiet enough for me. So he told me a story that the people are scared to death of the temple and at dark because they hear noises or sounds or calls coming out of the temple at night. Well, these are Muslim people. They're very superstitious. So the story goes that a guard fell asleep during the day inside, and nobody noticed it. And when they locked up, he was locked inside. And when he woke up, he was watching the gods and goddesses of Egypt step out of the walls and start walking around the room. And he went almost insane because he was locked in. So he was beating on the door. And, of course, nobody was coming because they were convinced that it was a spirit trying to scare them. And so he almost lost his mind, right? So my contact there said, I don't want anything to happen to you, Patricia. And I said, trust me, I am very comfortable with spirits. Lock me in. So we devised a plan because, of course, this is all illegal and you can go to jail if the authorities find out. The plan was we would pretend like I was just going in for the day, and then at the end of the day we would pretend like nobody noticed, like the guard, that I was still there. Well, I'll tell you something. This is a big temple, and there's no other way out but this door. It's not like some of the other temples in Egypt that are just sprawling in the desert. This is a confined space. And when they closed that key, and everybody was paid off, so backsheeshed, so that they would comply with this. And I heard the key turn once, click, 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 click. And it was resonating through this temple. I thought, Pat, you have really lost your mind. This is pushing the envelope. And I laid down there in the temple of Isis, the chapel of Isis. And I have to just say, for lack of a better word, I began to hallucinate. I was in the dark. And all of this immense energy. And at one point, I was in completely altered state. And I sat up, and I looked down the hall, and coming toward me were six Egyptian priests, ancient priests. And I could see like a beam of spark of light. So I was looking out. Of course, I was in such an altered state. But I was looking through this dark, huge place, and saw these beams of light. And then as they came closer to me, they started to appear as priests. And there was one coming up from behind who was the high priest. To make a long story shorter, at a certain point, they got up near me, and the guard, the police guard, just as they were coming close to me, and this high priest was looking into my eyes, it was like a laser sort of communication download. Right in the middle of this, the guard goes, Miss Patricia! Hello! Because word was out that somebody knew I was in the temple and they were going to talk to the police. So the guard came to get me and interrupted this experience. It might be better because I think I might not have come back to
to planet Earth. But what's interesting about this story is that later, Amir, the person, my contact there, told me, when I told him about the what I'd seen, he was flabbergasted. He said that there was a local man who was almost driven out of his mind because for a long time, every night, six priests and a high priest would come and take him out of bed and tell him to get off of the sacred land. And they would not leave him in peace until he went, because his house was on the sacred land, and his sewage was damaging the energy of the temple. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, fantastic. Did you recognize the type of dress they had?
Could you date it
in a way that you would say it was from very ancient Egypt or from the pharaonic times?
Oh, most definitely. That experience there that I'm talking about now, we're talking about 12, 13,000 years ago.
Right. So that was well before the times of the pharaohs.
No, the pharaohs were there 10, 12,000 years ago. The first kingdom.
Right. So that's a period that they haven't presumably recognized then, because doesn't the pharaoh reign start somewhat sort of more recent?
According to the history books, it does. But according to more radical Egyptologists like Stephen Mailer and me, and a wonderful soul whose name is Hakim Awiyan, who's no longer with us, the record books are wrong. And the true Egyptian history starts around 50,000 years ago with the Kemetian people.
With what people?
Sorry?
With what people did you say?
The Kemetians, K-H-E-M-I-T, Kemet.
Oh, got you. Right, yeah. That Kemu was the old name for Egypt, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that we're going to experience in our lifetime the rewriting of all those timelines, because they're wrong.
Absolutely. Now,
and that is very exciting. For example, this beautiful structure of the Osirian in Abydos, they keep trying to define it as being in a certain time frame of, I think, they want to stick it at 3,000 or 4,000 BC.
Right.
But there's no way. And when you talk to if you read Stephen Mailer's book, The Land of Osiris, or Where Pharaohs Dwell, talks about this being a simultaneous structure with the Great Sphinx, which is also impossible, the timelines that it gives it, that we were given it. I think you might have heard about Shok and his work of exploring the watermarks on the Sphinx.
Yes, I've seen a documentary on that one. It's very good.
Yeah. So he's a geologist, and he identifies watermarks on the Sphinx, which dates it back beyond any timelines that the historians have given us. And this wonderful teacher, Hakim Awiyan, who was the oral wisdom keeper of the Kemetians, he said, yes, Patricia, the Sphinx is 50,000 years old. And I said, what about the Osirian? He said, yes, Patricia, they're both 50,000 years old.
You've mentioned a link with Atlantis, where Egypt is concerned. It would seem to me that maybe at one time Egypt was a colony of Atlantis, but it seems their history has some continuity from those times right through ancient Egypt and onwards. Is that how you see it?
Well, yes. We've had many quite an animated discussion with this man, Hakim, who used to say, Patricia, why does it have to be an outside influence? The Kemetian civilization goes back through history. I said, relax. I'm suggesting, isn't it possible that these two great civilizations existed side by side? And he said, possibly. I said, surely it's possible that the later generations of Atlantis were as developed and sophisticated as Atlantis was. Surely they were sailing, they were traveling. And especially, I believe that there was no island of Atlantis. It was an entire continent in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes.
If you put a continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean following the North Atlantic Ridge in the Atlantic Ocean, bam, you now have very easy access to Africa, to North and South America, which would explain why we see similar structures in all these places.
I agree. That's so exactly where Plato put it, wasn't it, after he saw Sais, I think his name was, the Egyptian priest, when he related that story, that was precisely where he put Atlantis.
Who was that?
I think the priest was called Sais, who related the story to Plato. Confirming what you're saying, really.
Well, he said that Atlantis laid outside the pillars, the great pillars of the Straits of Gibraltar. But
yes,
I think that we're talking about an entire continent that went right down to South America.
Yes, yes.
So in my discussions with Hakim and other, let's call them radical Egyptologists, a new idea is taking form that this Kemetian civilization, which was comprised of 42 African tribes, one of them was the Dogon, which we know about.
Yes.
Were directly affected by Atlantis. This is what I believe, that they may have been given a lot of wisdom and a lot of gifts from Atlantis, but that they had their own immense culture as well.
Yes, I agree entirely with that. Do you think that, in light of what you said about this response you had to raising the possibility that Egypt was influenced by some other civilization, that Hawass has a similar objection, does he not, to linking it with Atlantis?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, he has, I think 2 days ago, he came out with a big statement that they now believe that the pyramids were not made by slaves. And it's like, duh, do you really think so? So he has the freedom to control a lot of the information that comes out about Egypt, and he knows so much more than we are allowed to know. His position is, why does it have to be, you know, the New Age people, they all want to talk about this Atlantis, but, you know, Egypt is Egypt, that's it. And I can understand that there is a lot of ego, collective ego and pride about the beginnings of that civilization. But I think it's also because he wants to discourage investigation. Here's the story, that's enough, that's all you need to know now, and stop asking, right?
Yes.
So we get these little dribbles of information, like this big... I couldn't believe this came out in all the major media, that Hawass has announced that it probably wasn't slaves, as we've been told. Well, of course, in Cosmos of Soul, I already say that this is, it's ridiculous to consider that such perfection,
absolutely,
such meticulous artistry as the pyramid would have been created by angry, struggling slaves. This is masters at work.
Right. Now,
and you can feel it as an intuitive and psychic.
You've got an opportunity here, Patricia, to do a bit of advertising, because I understand you're actually arranging a trip a little bit later this year to the Great Pyramid and Sphinx.
Yes, I have a group going, almost sold out now, on March 10th. It's March 10th to the 22nd, and
yes.
It's exciting because it's the first group I've done since the book has come out, and so all of the people have read the book, and there's quite a buzz about them being able to revisit some of those experiences with me. It's going to be quite a happening. And I've managed to block the Great Pyramid for private access on Equinox, March 21st.
Yeah. I must say, just in passing, I did my national service in Egypt at one end of the Suez Canal. And one of the few days I had an opportunity to get out was a visit to the Cairo Museum, but also to go inside the Great Pyramid, and it's quite an experience.
Did you go by yourself?
No, there were quite a few people in our group, so there were a number of us at the time going up the, what you might call, the causeway into the, what they used to call, the King's Chamber. So,
it's a pretty phenomenal experience. And we go in and we do sound work. I bring Tibetan bowls and we do chanting. And I have, I can tell you that there have been a few times where I thought that we were going to take off. People referred to the walls as undulating, the granite, because bearing in mind that granite, that the whole structure inside is granite. And granite is about 70% quartz. So it was, it's a resonant chamber. Because as you know, quartz is piezoelectric and it, it holds and it, it holds and, what's the word I'm looking for? It amplifies energy. So we, whenever I bring my groups in there, we chant and, whoa. 45, 50 people chanting in that room. It almost, it felt like it was going to just take off.
So make the walls disappear.
That would have been one for the book, you know. Great Pyramid takes off when zany psychic and friends.
Well, you would be in trouble.
Yeah, well, I probably wouldn't care wherever I was going.
Right, now, we're sort of quickly, because it's always happens this way when you've got a very interesting program, we're sort of getting near the end of it. I'd like to
already?
I'd like to give you
time.
Well,
that's a time warp.
Yeah, about your books and where to get them and things like that. But just still for a moment, staying on where pharaohs dwell, what were the conclusions you made as a result of writing the book? I mean, is there a message in it to people?
Yes. I'm having some pretty amazing responses to this book. There are people who write to me saying that it was a catharsis, that they had no idea they were holding these emotions within them and that they had been somehow released by the process. And others who say that they never imagined the depth of such emotion connected to Egypt. It's, but people are having some pretty profound experiences with the material and are also celebrating the courage and the spirit with which I've approached this infinite journey. I go to Egypt at least two or three times a year. And so one of the, there are a number of streams of information there. One of them is, I need to say the title is Where Pharaohs Dwell, One Mystic's Journey Through the Gates of Immortality. And one of the objectives of this book is to help people understand that the veil is coming down. It's really in Egypt much easier to experience that as it is in sacred England. The veil is coming down, and if you will allow yourself to approach these places in silence, as a humble student, and hopefully with someone who knows how to turn that key, you can experience other dimensional consciousness, right, very vividly. And it's a life-altering experience. And I want that. I want my people who read my work and to read the Syrian teachings to have some impact from that and to do something different to understand something more
A
deep level.
Tell you a short story to do with a visit to Egypt that might interest you. A friend of mine went with a party of people with a lady who...
Sorry, I've got to ask you to speak up a little bit. I can barely hear you.
Right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, better. Thanks.
Oh, okay, fine. I've probably turned away from the mic a bit. Yes, I was going to mention that my friend went with a group of people to the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx, and like all people do, they were taking lots of photographs whilst they were there. And when my friend developed a photograph that they took from one point away from the Great Pyramid, in the background you could see two UFOs. And the funny thing was that when this lady wrote her book about that experience, she used a similar photograph taken from that position at, when the same group was there. And in her photograph, there are no UFOs, but in his one, there are two. And I thought that was quite remarkable.
That is remarkable. Do you have access to those photos?
I think somewhere in my library, yes, I possibly still have the original book and a copy of his photograph. Yeah, I think I'm sure.
Well,
I'd love to
know that, and I'm sure your readers would too. So, if you have a chance to announce that in another show or send me an email, I would really love to see those pictures.
I'll see what I can arrange for you, Patricia. Definitely, yes. I'll have to seek it out. It's funny, it's only through talking to you that it's reminded me that somewhere I've got that. I can't remember the lady's name now, but that doesn't matter too much.
That's pretty interesting information.
Big pub?
Yeah.
Right. Now, do you want to... I know your website address is pretty straightforward, but in case anyone is listening who's not aware of it, you might like to give that out.
Okay, it's www.syrianrevelations.net or patriciacorey.com.
Right. Is the syrianrevelations.com, you said?
.net,
beg your pardon. Is that vastly different to your own Patricia Corey site? I mean...
Yes, the SyrianRevelations.net site is full of information. It's really an informative site, and it also has the book purchase capacity there, but it's really quite chock full of a lot of information that I've been accumulating over this time. It's got a nice blog with what I call the human voice, different articles that I think are really important for people to read. So it's a site that you can get quite a lot of information from, whereas patriciacorey.com is just kind of a little bit superficial intro, what I'm up to, what the media are saying, and that kind of thing. So people who want to really learn more should go to SyrianRevelations.net.
Right. So they can buy any one of your books direct from the site, or presumably big stockists like Amazon would have it if they wanted to go to them.
Oh, yeah, my books are everywhere now. You can find them at Amazon or any of the online shops or my site or in bookstores. You can, if they don't have it, you can always order it.
Right. We've just about reached the last few minutes, and I shall need a couple to announce next week's guest. Just a quickie here. You've said your next book will be Beyond the Matrix, Daring Conversations with Brilliant Minds of Our Time. Do you know yet when that's coming out?
Yes, it's coming out in on May 24th of this year. It's a collection of interviews and pretty dynamic conversations with some very exciting people. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. It would be nice, I think, looking ahead, if we're both still here, to have you back sometime, perhaps after the release of that book, and have a chat about that one with you.
Oh, I would love it. Thank you.
Yeah. Right, have you got a final message for our listeners? Because we've got about 2 minutes left, and I need one of those to announce next week's
guest. Okay, yeah, I do have a final message. Be filled with wonder. Open your mind to what is possible and what you create with every thought. Be filled with wonder and celebration. And know that we are on our way. We're here. We came here for a purpose. We're here. We are. This is it. I can't wait. And that's my message. Be filled with wonder.
Thank you very much, Patricia. It's been delightful to have you on the program. I'm so glad that you came. It's been a terrifically interesting session with you. And all the best of luck with your next tour and your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Goodbye. Goodbye, all. Oh. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Right, friends, 1 minute here to say that next week I have Kerry O'Connor coming, who has a unique and pioneering approach to deliver information directly from the soul. She has a lifelong partnership with her spirits and guides and an ongoing interaction with them, and she is able to energetically read a person's life story by decoding the messages that are found in everyone's energy field. So that sounds a rather interesting program. Thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can be with me next week. Thank you, everyone. God bless you all. Thank you.